are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Monday, October 21st, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks on a Sam Michael hybrid day. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, a brand new interview that Sam just concluded just a couple days ago, Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor, by Virginia Eubanks. Silicon Valley apparently not so liberating. And speaking of which, Pete Buttigieg is being secretly advised by Mark Zuckerberg. Another reason to hate Mayor Pete, although I have to say, I don't think he needs the advice to help with connectivity. Brendan and Jamie here. Matt on a waterboat trip. Kurdish forces deport border as part of a so-called ceasefire with the Turks. U.S. troops redeploying to Kurdish Iraq, where they are greeted with epithets and stones for abandoning the northern Syria's Kurds. Trump reverses course on hosting the G7 at his club after learning that impeachment-wary Republicans are tired of defending him. Fine, whatever. Bernie Sanders packed Queensbridge. Potentially 35,000 people, the largest rally of the election so far, with speeches by, among others, AOC, Michael Moore, and my personal hero, Nina Turner. Incredible momentum.
It was all right.
It was not bad. Peace Now activists suggest that the Warren campaign, in addition to its public shakiness on justice for Palestinians, is playing a double game between public statements and AIPAC. Chile, anti-austerity protests take aim at the economic reforms that never happened, even after the removal of the Pinochet regime. Solidarity in Lebanon and Iraq, anti-austerity protests, which reflect what happened in Syria, are taking place across the Middle East, and in Iraq and Lebanon, taking place across class and sectarian lines. That very same agent of Facebook, Pete Buttigieg, is surging in Iowa. UN chief strongly condemns a mosque attack which killed 62 in Afghanistan. Evo Morales leading in the polls in the first round of voting in Bolivia, but they are likely headed to a second round. And Elizabeth Warren, I guess, is going to release her own healthcare plan. I thought she was on board for Medicare for All. We'll see what she puts together. All that, and Joe Biden still hemorrhaging money from private flights. Maybe if that isn't even true, I just wanted to say it again because it's very funny. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Brendan on the board.
Howdy, Michael.
How's it going? How are you feeling?
I'm doing well. I am assuming the Leckian powers of the board today and feeling very powerful.
You feeling that energy?
I really am.
You were not at the Sanders rally this weekend. You were out living good life.
I had some prior engagements, but everything I heard and all the people I saw on the subway who I talked to going throughout the city seemed to have a great time. And, you know, we got a lot of clips from it today, so stay tuned. And
one major missed opportunity at the Sanders rally. And I was talking about on my show how the television advertisements for Sanders are not as good in this cycle, and they really need to up that game. TV still matters. And not bringing him out to one mic in Queensbridge was an incredible missed opportunity.
Oh, Back in Black was good, though.
That was hilarious. The fact that Bernie actually did come out to AC/DC cracked me up. But
I'm Back in Black.
It should have been One Mic. He was right literally next to the Queensbridge projects, and he's a One Mic guy. Like, all I need is one healthcare plan, one mic, one movement. Like, that's, he's a very, Bernie's been One Mic for decades while everybody else was being mediocre. Jamie, what did you think?
I thought it was pretty good. I got to say, you know, I'm skeptical of electoralism, as you know. When someone, it's the phrase, a working class revolution at the ballot box kind of makes me sad at the end of it. But I think this is really important. He's the best chance we got on a presidential electoral level. And he's talking about class politics and unions and it's, and racial justice, and it's really good.
I loved what Matt Crisman, who I actually ran into there. I loved that he just tweeted out, can't think of a much more privilege than seeing the single best chance to shift our political horizons and provide real material benefits to millions of people than we've ever had, and go, meh. Those are precisely my sentiments. Crisman definitely gets the retweet and quote on that. All right, but there's also an election taking place in Canada today. You know, Canada has the advantage of potentially being able to elect a coalition government. I have no doubt that as NDP leader Jagmeet Singh surges in the polls, Justin Trudeau will be, you know, first Justin would ignore him, then he will ridicule him, then he will put on makeup to look like him. And you have an opportunity to vote for NDP. By the way, Jagmeet Singh is the only leader, certainly not the Greens. The Greens, which are a horrific bourgeoisie mess with incredibly embarrassing marketing. They are the only party leader who has said that he will never coalition with the Conservative ascendancy. So you are voting against Andrew Scheer if you vote for NDP. And likely it could be a Liberal NDP coalition. Here is Jagmeet Singh, the last rally of the campaign, I believe. Last campaign video is campaign released. Look, I mean, you know, I have my critiques, but he's putting something on the ballot in Canada that is unprecedented and reflects this broader global pattern. And it's been nice to see him take off.
Friends, I want to talk to you about what's at stake in this election and why it matters so much. People tell me again and again, they can't wait 4 more years for help. And they're demanding that governments take action. On October 21st, no matter what Canadians choose, I want Canadians to win. In your life, think about the times you made a decision where you chose something out of fear. Think about the times when you took that chance, what happened, and how much your life became better. I want to say in this election, you can vote for what you believe in. The Conservatives have made their choice to help out the rich and powerful. Justin Trudeau has made his choice to help out the big polluters and the wealthiest corporations. They've chosen those at the very top. In this election, I choose you. Choose all of you.
He's also faced, you know, a lot of racism and discrimination because of his, you know, Sikh identity. And, you know, of the kind of expected stupid sort and disgusting, unacceptable sort that you see, you know, everywhere, but also very specifically the highbrow version of people trying to connect him with Sikh separatist movements and Khalistani politics from the 1980s. And I think it's worth actually noting that there's actually a very strong wellspring in the Sikh tradition that overlaps and reinforces the type of social democratic message that he's putting forward. This is a religion that really does actually preach and talk quite a bit about interconnectedness and community base of solidarity, in fact. So I think the way he has carried those things together in a very seamless way, in a way, again, that really is not a just, you know, a signifier, but is really deeply connected to his politics, his clarity about anti-racism, and his call to fundamentally expand the Canadian healthcare and safety net and start to move in the right direction on Indigenous people and First Nations rights and environmental rights is extremely laudable and deserves our support. If I was in Canada, I would vote NDP. One of today's sponsors is News Voice, which is the first ever entirely open, crowdsourced, and democratized platform for news. You can download the app for free at newsvoice.com/majority. In a country where the vast majority of news is owned by the same five huge corporations, it's important for us to always pay attention to where our news is coming from. Who owns who owns which media outlets, and what political biases may be in play. And that's exactly what News Voice helps you keep track of. News Voice is a free, crowdsourced website and mobile app that lets you create a personalized news feed and maintain a clear picture of where your news is coming from and what political slants may exist. It helps you aggregate news from corporate outlets, international outlets, local news, and independent media, giving you access to every side of every story. News Voice is fueled by its community of users who contribute to the platform by fact-checking, submitting stories and sources that are missing, upvoting stories, and writing story summaries. You can also comment on stories and debate politics with other members of the community. And through staying active in the community, you can level up and earn perks on the platform. News Voice Play feature lets you listen to your personalized news feed every day through customizable audio news playlists. It's your own personally tailored radio station for news. Very lucky. And News Voice is a next generation news aggregator and social media platform that values transparency, good journalism, and productive political discussions. Get totally free access by going to newsvoice.com/majority. I'll put a link underneath this video if you're watching on YouTube. And today's show is also brought to you by Proactive. It always seems like that on the days you have something important, a pimple appears. But now at Proactive, you have the solution. With America's number one acne brand, Proactive has helped fight acne for almost 25 years. And now they've introduced their next generation acne treatment system, Proactive MD, which contains a dermatologist recommended topical retinoid called adapalene.
I use it.
Adapalene. A topical retinoid called adapalene. It's the newest acne fighting innovation made available over the counter to consumers in over 30 years. Old Kelly, who used to be on the boards, this is her testimonial on Proactive. I've been using Proactive on and off since high school. The formula has improved over the years, but the ideas remain the same. Proactive is a program of skincare that gives you short and long-term results. It's the best acne-fighting product that doesn't require a prescription, and it's been that way for a long time. I have sensitive skin, and Proactive's program has made my skin smoother and clearer without causing redness and peeling. This is the perfect time of year to start Proactive program for many people because school is starting up soon, and it only takes a few weeks to achieve a notable difference in your skin. Confidence makes all the difference, and going back to school with noticeably clearer skin gives you one less thing to worry about. Proactive is reliable. It fights acne. It improves brightness and overall appearance of my skin. It's the best regimen I've ever used. That is a powerful testimony from Kelly. You got to follow that advice and get on it. Right now, our listeners can go to proactive.com/majority to receive an exclusive on-the-go bag, which features Proactive's T-Zone Oil Absorber, Body Acne Wipes, and Green Tea Moisturizer. That's close to 100% value. That's close to a $100 value, and there's a 60-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's proactive.com/majority. Proactive.com/majority to order and get clear skin for the win. We're going to take a brief break, and we will be right back with Virginia Eubanks on automating inequality.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Virginia Eubanks. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of Albany, SUNY, and the author of, among other books, Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor. Virginia, welcome to the program.
Sam, thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
Now, your first chapter is From Poorhouse to Database. Just will you remind people, just because you're using it as an important metaphor, I think, here, what is a poorhouse?
Yeah, so it's amazing because we all kind of know what a poorhouse is because it shows up in our language, right? Like, oh, you kids are going to send me to the poorhouse. Or it shows up on our roads, right? There's still roads in many communities called like Poor Farm Road or Poor House Road. But we also kind of don't know what they are. So it's this really interesting sort of cultural phenomenon, I think, of the way we think about poor houses. And I use the digital poorhouse as sort of a metaphor in the book because I think the tools that I'm looking at in public assistance are really sort of more evolution than revolution, and I really wanted to put the tools in context, and that context ends up going way, way, way back in our history, like as far back as 1819, if not earlier. And basically what was happening in 1819 is this huge economic depression, this economic dislocation, and economic elites did what they do when this happens, and they sort of put out a bunch of studies, and the question they were asking in the studies was, like, what's the problem really? Is it poverty, that is sort of lack of access to resources, or is it pauperism, which meant at the time sort of that you would ask for help when you were struggling economically? And not surprisingly, for a bunch of studies that came out of Harvard and Yale, the studies all came back saying, you know, the real problem is not poverty, it's pauperism. It's the fact that people are asking for support. And so they invented at the time sort of a solution for that problem, which was to create this system of county poorhouses, which were brick and mortar institutions that basically incarcerated poor people as a condition for receiving help. So in order to enter the poorhouse, if you had the right at the time, you had to give up your right to vote and hold office, you couldn't marry, you were separated from your children who were then sort of farmed out as free labor as domestics and agricultural laborers. And also the death rates at some of these institutions were really astronomical, like 30% a year. So that distinction that poorhouses created, the sort of deep social programming I think we invented at that time, is this idea that the first thing our public services should do is make distinctions between the sort of deserving and the undeserving poor. And that is why I use that metaphor to place these new tools in sort of that history, that what they do is the same thing that county poorhouses were doing in 1819, which is raise barriers to receiving help so high that nobody but the absolute most desperate people will ask.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I have to admit, like, you know, I was exactly one of those people who would use, you know, sort of new poorhouse. I was in the concept, but I had no idea until reading your book about the, you know, where I start to that notion of poorhouses being basically reformatories. And we definitely hear the echoes of that. Just rhetorically, I can't help but think of Paul Ryan and sort of like his story about the kid who would rather have a lunch rather than, you know, a brown bag lunch rather than free lunch at school. Like there is some type of moral righteousness to not being poor, essentially.
Right. Or to asking for help.
And asking for help is a sign of some lack of moral righteousness or righteousness, period. And so the argument you're making is that we no longer have these poorhouses, but that technology, and I guess you tell me if I'm wrong about this, is in some way sort of allowing us to reconstruct the poorhouse without it being so clear that's what we're doing.
Yeah, so I'd say that What we're really doing is building, so I talk about it in the book, is a digital poorhouse with these sort of new statistical models, with artificial intelligence, with machine learning, algorithmic decision making, specifically in public service programs. So I look at cash assistance and supplemental nutritional assistance or food stamps. I look at homeless services in unhoused communities. And I look at child protective services as well, that we're building these sort of invisible institutions that contain people, like physically in space, that profile their future behavior and that police and surveil their sort of everyday lives. And I think that's very similar to what the poorhouse did in 1819. So yeah, I do think we're starting to sort of recreate those systems, but in a much harder to see way, which is, I think, one of the things that makes these new tools so dangerous.
Yeah, and I want to return to that sort of a broad critique, but first let's go through the examples that you use. You start in Indiana. And like you mentioned, you are you basically recount the introduction of a new system that essentially governs these various benefits that folks living in poverty get from via the Indiana state government. And you look at, and before you get into the details, I mean, specifically, I want to talk maybe about the Stipes family, and you also a woman, Omega Young. But you made a decision to sort of enter into these processes sort of from the customer base rather than sort of looking at it. The perspective is from the customer base, if you will, as opposed to sort of like the managerial perspective.
Yeah, so I think it's really important, particularly just in the last sort of year or two, there's been some really incredible work that's come out that is sort of taking a second look at technological systems like machine learning, like artificial intelligence. Like, we're in the middle of like a critical reexamination. I think it's really important, this moment. But one of the things that was frustrating to me about those conversations is that we so rarely heard from the people who are most impacted by these systems. So I think of it as, you know, we usually hear from designers, we often hear from policymakers, sometimes users in the sense of like frontline caseworkers who use the systems, but we pretty much never hear from people who see themselves as targets of these systems. And I think it's just really crucial to hear their voices, both in terms of understanding their experience and understanding their sort of analysis of what's happening, because I find they have a lot less to lose in sort of playing nice around these arguments, and they have some really compelling analyses of like what's happening in the world. And one of the stories I tell at the beginning of the book is actually about some work I did in this area a long time ago now, 20 plus years ago now. So it was probably 2000, and I was sitting in a tech lab that I had helped build with a community of women who lived in basically a single room occupancy hotel. And I was sort of shooting the breeze with one of the women who had worked on the project with me, and we were talking about technology, and I was asking her about her electronic benefits transfer card, her EBT card, which is the sort of debit-like card you get public assistance benefits on now. And they were new at the time, and so I was asking her about them. And she said, oh, yeah, you know, it's good in some ways. It's a little bit more convenient. Maybe there's less stigma at the grocery store. But also, my caseworker uses the sort of digital record of my purchases that it produces to track all of my movements and question all of my spending. And I must have had this like crazy, shocked, naive look on my face, because she just like pointed at me and laughed for like 2 solid minutes. And then she got really serious and she was like, oh, Virginia, you guys should be paying attention to what's happening to us, because they're coming for you next. And I really feel like that analysis is really spot on, and like 15 years before anyone else had it. So I think there's really important reasons morally to pay attention to what the experiences are of people who are most affected by these tools. But I also just think if we want to be smart about what's going to happen in the future around these tools, we need to be looking in these communities that are seen as sort of where it's okay to experiment.
Exactly, right. And it's fascinating, because I have a system with my daughter where I give her allowance on a debit card. And I see wherever she spends.
Do you track her spending? Of course you do.
And I try to tell her, like, here, just let me give you some cash too, so that you
right.
just have this ability to go and, you know, I don't know, go to Starbucks and buy a coffee without me knowing it, or something to that effect. And this is, it's becoming ubiquitous, I think, in many respects. But all right, let's go into this the story of Indiana. There is a $1.4 billion contract with high tech companies, and there seems to be like sort of like competing narratives going on here with this, that are both like, they do this because this is a way, you know, there's the sort of the classic story of like, oh, the way we're going to deal with our school is to build more stuff because I'm friends with the guy who owns the cement company in town. And also this is a way where we can impose our biases and we can make political decisions that don't look like political decisions.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It's one of the things that happens when we look at these tech systems. It's not that the tech systems, that their politics are necessarily better or worse than the current politics we have. It really depends on the system. I think one of the real dangers is they pretend, they're like stories pretending they're not stories. Or it's politics pretending it's not politics. Like, oh, this is just like an administrative change. It's just a little tweak. It's more objective. We're not making policy. But the reality is these are political decision-making machines. And I'll give you an example from Indiana. So in Indiana in 2006, then-Governor Mitch Daniels contracted with IBM and ACS and a number of other companies to what they said at the time was a modernization of the public assistance eligibility programs in the state of Indiana, meaning how you applied for and were judged eligible or not eligible for public services like cash benefits or food stamps. And the system that they built, one of the sort of understandings that got built into the system was that if you at any point failed to give the system information it needed to make a determination in your case, then that was a failure to basically cooperate in establishing your eligibility for the program, which could then be used as a way to kick you off the program. Because there's this really old rule on the books that basically was there if somebody who was applying just like refused to come to meetings over and over or you know, was just being so difficult that you had to deny them. They basically built that rule into any kind of failure in the system was understood as this intentional failure to cooperate with establishing eligibility in the program, which was enough reason to deny you services. So, for example, Omega Young was an African-American mother of two grown sons. She was on Medicaid. She had, after the new system had been brought online, they moved from one-on-one meetings with caseworkers in person to meetings that were scheduled through sort of a telephone scheduling system, and that you then received a call from a call center, from a worker in a call center to do your eligibility or your recertification interview. So she was unable to make the time they picked for her. She called her county office to say, hey, I can't make that time. They somehow didn't get that message. They called her the call center called her at the set time. She wasn't there. She wasn't there to get the call. And so they checked the box that said failure to cooperate in establishing eligibility. And they denied her all of the benefits that she was already on. So Medicaid, food stamps, free transportation to medical appointments, and which put her in incredible jeopardy because the reason she missed the appointment was she was in the hospital with terminal ovarian cancer. So she was denied all the benefits that were supporting her while she was sick. She actually died on March 1st, 2009. 2 days later, there was a hearing on the denial of her benefits because she did actually appeal that decision. There was a hearing, and they recognized that it was their mistake and returned all of her benefits 2 days after she died.
And so this is in the alternate universe, the older universe, she's meeting with a caseworker. She has a direct relationship with them. They understand that she's in the hospital. This is not a time we would schedule it for. I would never cut this person off, the caseworker would react theoretically.
You would hope so, right? Yeah. And certainly frontline discretion in casework has historically been a place where racial discrimination has entered the system, and also discrimination against single parents or people who are sexual minorities or migrants, like lots of places for human bias to enter the system. The reality, though, of the system in Indiana is that it denied 1 million applications in the first 3 years of this experiment, which was more than a 50% increase in from the 3 years before the experiment. So that it basically, rather than shifting the way public assistance works, it just sped up sort of the worst parts of the system, which resulted in just incredible human suffering for these families.
And to what extent, I mean, when we look at something like this, this seems to me to be, and certainly, you know, I have some familiar with Pence as governor in Indiana. This seems to be like mission accomplished, right? Like we were able to privatize this funding by paying these tech firms, and we were able to cull our Medicaid rolls. It's block grant. I would assume that they're working on a block grant, and we were able to cull our Medicaid rolls, and we can divert those funds where we want, et cetera, et cetera. Like this is mission accomplished.
Yeah, so I often say when I talk about the book that I don't know what was in Mitch Daniels' heart when he made the decision to sign this contract. So I can't speak directly to his intentions. But one of the folks I interviewed for the book, this Medicaid attorney in Bloomington, I think put it really well. He said, look, if we had a system that had been built to deny people on purpose, it wouldn't have worked any better than the system that we got. And so at a certain point, intentions don't really matter. What matters is the impact on people. And that's why it's sort of as the cases in the book develop, the sort of intention gets much murkier. It's because I wanted to step people through this process of recognizing, like, it's not necessarily that their politicians are, you know, misusing technology. It's that this deep social programming and the technology keeps reemerging in a way, no matter what your intentions are. And that forces us to ask some really tough questions.
And what ultimately happened with the program?
Well, there's good news in this case, which is the people of Indiana like sort of found out what was happening and just wouldn't stand for it. And so there was basically a big movement in the state of Indiana that came out of a series of town hall meetings where people who were affected came together to talk about their stories. They pushed back on the governor. He was forced to cancel this 10-year contract 3 years into the contract. And in many ways, the people of Indiana won. The sort of afterword is a bit sad, though, which is after the governor broke the contract, IBM turned around and sued the state for breach of contract. And in the first several rounds through the courts, actually won. They finally worked it out. That the damages went in the way of the state, but it wasn't much, as maybe $100 million coming back to the state. They you know, spent $500 million to deny 1 million people benefits in the long run.
Unbelievable. All right. Well, so let's move to Los Angeles, where you look at the question of housing. Where does the automation, where does the algorithm come in here?
Yes, so the system I studied in L.A. Is a system called the Coordinated Entry System. And it's not just happening in Los Angeles. It's actually sort of standard practice just about everywhere in the United States and increasingly abroad as well. But it was really interesting to look at it in L.A. because Los Angeles County has one of the highest unhoused populations in the country. I think it's something like, as the last point in time count, it's close to 60,000 people who are unhoused in Los Angeles County, and something like 75% of them are completely unsheltered, meaning they have no access to emergency shelter. They're just living in tents or cars or under bridges. So it's an extraordinary humanitarian crisis, the housing crisis in L.A., and I looked at that system. So it's known by its proponents as the Match.com of homeless services. And the intention is quite good. The intention is to, because there are so many unhoused people in LA and so few resources, the intention is to risk rate all of the unhoused people in terms of their vulnerability to some of the worst outcomes of being homeless. And those are pretty severe. There's death and medical issues and mental health crises and community violence, all kinds of horrible things that can happen to you when you're unhoused. And then to match folks based on their vulnerability score with the most appropriate available housing resource that is out there for them. And so it's actually serving some people very, very well. So people really close to the very top of the scale basically weren't served well by the system before because they are hard to work with. And so most of the time they wouldn't get resources that caseworkers might save for slightly easier to deal with clients. People at the bottom of the scale, the least vulnerable, are actually doing pretty well because they're being matched with very time and resource limited resources like what's known as rapid rehousing. But the reality is something like 30,000 people in the middle have been surveyed by this very intrusive instrument that they use to vulnerability rank people and aren't seeing any resources at all come out of it. And I really wanted to talk to them about what their experience is. So I talked to a guy named Gary Boatwright, and he goes by the nickname Uncle Gary in Skid Row in L.A., and he said he was really concerned, for example, with like where his information was going, because this survey they have to fill out asks questions like, are you currently trading sex for drugs or money? Are you thinking about hurting yourself or someone else? Is there someone out there who thinks, you know, that you owe them money? Are there open warrants on you? And then they ask if they can take a picture, and then they ask where you can be found at different times of the day. And Uncle Gary told me, hey, it feels like I'm being asked to incriminate myself in exchange for a slightly higher lottery number for housing. And it's actually, a really good analysis, because it turns out that the database that they keep this information in, it's called the Homeless Management Information Service HMIS, under federal data law can be accessed with no warrant based only on an oral request by law enforcement. So there's some real issues about where this data goes, who it's shared with, and whether or not the people who are giving up their data really have a choice in whether it's really voluntary. They sign an informed consent form, but the reality is this is pretty much the only way to get into housing in Los Angeles County. So everyone's going to say yes, even if they're not comfortable with sharing such intensely personal information about themselves.
And this is another example of essentially the policing, right? I mean that. We're basically talking about policing without police.
Yeah. So that's definitely how many of the unhoused people I talked to felt about it. I mean, there were definitely folks I talked to who were like, "This was a gift from God. I'm so glad it happened because they got housed, and that's a really big deal." But a lot of the folks who had gone through the survey and had participated in the system and had received no resources at all, started to sit back and sort of think, like, wait, what are they using this for, really? And I think it's a really legitimate question to ask about the system. There's no reason that law enforcement should have access to that information. No reason except for if you want to police unhoused people, if you want to be able to arrest and incarcerate unhoused people.
And are we seeing that? I mean, in this program, maybe not in L.A., but in other municipalities where they're using it?
Yeah, so coordinated entry is actually pretty common across the country. It is a fairly easy fix, though. Like, we could fix the federal data rules that say that law enforcement can access the homeless management information system. We could fix that tomorrow. We could just be like, no, you can't.
But do we know that there are police departments that are accessing it and using it as a way of dealing with their, you know, dealing with their homelessness problem?
So currently, I only know about Los Angeles, but currently LAPD says they do not themselves access data in HMIS, but they are legally allowed to walk into a social service center and ask caseworkers for information out of the system. Caseworkers are not required to give it to them, and I think that's really important. but they are allowed to give it to them, and many of them do. And so I would say they are accessing the system when they are looking at criminal justice cases or looking at looking to make an arrest. They'd absolutely go into homeless shelters and ask for information out of HMIS.
And we should say that this is, we can see what's happening with, let's say, ICE in many respects, what the implications of this are. And when, you know, President Trump says, well, we're going to move into California, and he seems to have dropped this idea for the time being, but we're going to do something about the homelessness there.
Yeah.
That would be the mechanism they would use.
Yeah, I think. So I think, actually, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think when we have this conversation about intention, one of the things that's really important is to understand that these systems will work no matter what the intention is. So the best example, I think, is actually the DACA database, the Deferred Action on Childhood
Right.
Arrival database, right? So under an Obama administration, the idea was to collect names of people to protect them from deportation. But when the administration changed, all of a sudden, there's a database of 800,000 Yep. undocumented people that are in the hands of an executive with a very different idea about what to do with that information. And so one of the things that I think a lot about when I think about solutions is having kind of a what Dana Boyd would call like a hacker mindset, which is like, think first, how do I break the system? Not like, how is it going to work if everybody's like holding hands and singing kumbaya and all have the same idea about what's best, but like, how do I use this against its intention? And if you can do that, like, don't do it. Like, how do we harden these systems against uses that even the designers would find deplorable? Because
Right.
once it's out there, it's out there.
Right. What do you do if Donald Trump is running it? Essentially,
exactly.
I mean, that's basically.
Yeah.
All right. Well, lastly, let's talk about briefly the Allegheny County. You went to Allegheny County in Pennsylvania, and there's a system that flags for potential neglect, abuse of children. What was problematic about that system?
Well, so the system's called the Allegheny Family Screening Tool, and it's supposed to be able to predict which children might be victims of abuse or neglect in the future. And I think everybody would agree, actually, that's a really important question. And so it really felt like the stakes of this were incredibly high, both in terms of protecting children and in terms of keeping families intact and healthy. So this is a system that is built on top of a data warehouse that the county built back in 1999 that collects information from like 29 different county and state programs. So like adult and juvenile probation, the housing authority, drug and alcohol services, the police department, office of mental health, a bunch of other things, school districts, for example. And then on top of that data, they hired a team of economists and computer scientists from New Zealand and off of the U.S. to design a system that could red flag who they think are the most vulnerable, the most the riskiest families in terms of potential future abuse or neglect. The problem, though, is so it's basically comes up on like a thermometer, sort of green on the bottom and red on the top. And if your score is in the red, if it's high enough on a 0 to 20 scale, they actually automatically open an investigation on your family so that it refers your family for investigation unless it's overridden by a supervisor. The problem, though, is that it doesn't actually model child maltreatment because we have actually very limited data on children who are actually physically, emotionally, or sexually abused. What it does, and not enough information to basically build a viable model, so it uses proxies, which basically just means sort of a stand-in for actual neglect or abuse. And originally one of the proxies it used was called call re-referral. And basically all that means is a call has been placed on the child to sort of a hotline. It's screened out by their call screeners as not sort of crucial enough to step in or as not actually abuse and neglect. And then there's a second call placed on the same child within 2 years. And that seems reasonable, except that it's really open information in most poor working class neighborhoods, most neighborhoods that are affected by child protective services, that vendetta calling happens a lot. So like a neighbor has a party and you're pissed, you call Child Protective Services. You're breaking up with somebody and it's not going well, you call Child Protective Services. Like sometimes children call Child Protective Services on their parents to like exert some control in their family.
Divorce, so, I would imagine too.
Is also- divorce all the time, absolutely. And so the fact that they thought this might be an appropriate a stand-in for abuse or neglect actually occurring is actually incredibly troubling because it says that these data scientists and economists actually don't know a lot about the system that they're trying to model, so they're modeling the wrong things. And that gets those choices are made invisible when all call screeners are seeing is this thermometer that says, oh, 17 out of 20.
Right.
Like it's out of your hands. We're just opening an investigation. Like that doesn't show up. So again, it's a way that we like we hide these actually political decisions behind this sort of math washed facade of like clean objective numbers.
And the lack of sort of like ongoing contact, right? That would make these it's really the lack of discretion in the in these contexts. Or is it, I mean, So just to broaden out the discussion as we start to wrap up here a little bit, the it seems there's like a multitude of problems with these things that range from the assumptions that people make at the beginning that are both political and just sort of, I guess, maybe detached, right? I mean, like there's a quality to that Allegheny system, which is sort of indicative of like maybe some elements of education reform where it's, you know, we're doing this based on data and we don't have any real world educational experience. And so we just, you know, I guess apply a metrics that don't really have anything to do with this. I mean, so there's multiple different levels, it seems to me, that this can go wrong. Is how do we how do you fix it or can you like, I mean, is it possible to rely on technology to do these things without it, obscuring the problems?
Yeah. So I think one of the big points that I want people to take away from the book is that we often sort of talk about these systems as disruptors or as equalizers even, right? Like this is evidence-based policymaking. This is more objective. This is removing human discretion. But in the cases that I look at in public services, the reality is they act much more like intensifiers or amplifiers of the systems we already have in place. And so changing the way these technologies operate is not as easy as, you know, having better intentions at the beginning or even, you know, training computer engineers to understand more about sort of social inequality. But it's going to require really deep cultural and political change. But in the meantime, we need to create systems that do less harm, or we need to give people the ability, people in communities to give the ability to have the ability to say no to things that don't fit their community values. So it feels like rather than trying to go the route of taking all of our values out of these technologies, which just means you're building them for the status quo, what we need to do is actually build them with our values front and center. Unfortunately, right now, by default, we're building these systems with only values like efficiency and cost savings. But we should be building them from the point of view of equity and justice and fairness and human dignity and self-determination. So you get a really different system if you design from the principle that public services actually should be a floor under everyone. That is a human rights approach that says no one is allowed to, you know, have their family broken up because a parent couldn't afford a child's medication, or like allow someone like Gary Boatwright to live in a tent on the street in Los Angeles for 2 decades. At any point, we can say that's unacceptable. But the reality is these tools just reproduce this idea of the moral thermometer, right? They just say we're coming at this from a triage approach, which says there's not enough resources for everyone. We have to decide who really deserves them. When in reality, the most complicated math is what activist Sherry Honkola calls the belly button algorithm, which is like who deserves housing Do you have a belly button? Then you deserve housing.
Right.
You deserve food? Do you have a belly button? Right. So the reality is, I believe we're using these systems as a kind of empathy override, right? They allow us to think the most horrifying situations are getting corrected, but everybody else maybe kind of deserves it. And maybe they should go to jail, or maybe they should lose their kids. And the reality is, no one should go to jail for being poor, and no one should lose their kids for being poor. And that's the basic assumption we have to make when we build programs or these digital tools.
I mean, I guess these tools, they both function to obscure the values that are inputted into them, but they also, I guess, your book helps put them in stark relief, and certainly is an argument, like you say, for something like the belly button rule, where maybe we don't need a process to determine who is eligible for this. Maybe we should just provide enough that making that process obsolete on some level, so that everybody's eligible, and we just put our resources into that.
Yeah, I think we all deserve better. That's why I wrote the book.
It's a fascinating piece of work. Virginia Eubanks, the book is Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for the conversation.
I've been advocating the belly button rule for over 40 years. And some of us have followed suit. Some of us thought that there should be a testing mechanism to see how your belly button, how much lint was in it before you got health care. That's
all
not
kinds
what I
of
believe
means
in.
Testing as to whether or not you have an innie or an outie.
Do you have an innie? Do you have an outie?
How
does it look at
weird
the pool?
That...
Does it have a weird one? Is it twistable?
We need to spread the lint around.
Whether or not it's a disgusting belly button or a normal one, you should be able to have health care, in my opinion.
All right, folks, we're going to go to the fun half, going to touch a little bit on, well, obviously, this great Bernie rally, Mike Pompeo having a little bit of a tantrum. What kind of energy did you say he brought, Brendan?
Big Paul Manafort-type energy.
Some Paul Manafort-type energy. I used to think, I don't know, yeah, Pompeo's such a bag of shit. He's so disgusting. He's, Jesus Christ, I don't even want to contemplate what that guy's belly button is like. Yuck.
But housing, healthcare.
Housing, yeah, Mike Pompeo deserves housing and healthcare. And, I mean, you know, there could be some parameters around the housing and healthcare that he deserves. Speaking of which, I would like to acknowledge that I was the one of the ringleaders of the lock him up chant at the Bernie rally.
I heard that chant. That was me.
I was
very proud of you.
I was trying to get that started for a long time, and then finally, when the mayor of San Juan was talking about Trump in Puerto Rico, it broke out.
Oh, yeah. There were some real energetic folks near me, too, like just yelling all sorts of nice heckles. It was great.
Lock him up. Lock him up. But, of course, it's like, no, no, no. Vote him out. We need that libidinal energy. And incidentally, like, literally, dude should probably be locked up.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if we're going to lock people up.
If we're going to have prisons, we should definitely put Donald Trump in one.
Oh, I would be really, actually, it would be even more funny to send him to some type of like enlightened Swedish prison where he had to take like emotional enrichment courses and had like mandated watercoloring. And like, no, stop. I don't want to introspect. Okay. Today's show is brought to you by Proactiv, introducing Proactiv's next-generation acne treatment system. Proactiv MD, which contains an innovative dermatologist-recommended topical retinoid called adapalene. Right now, our listeners can go to proactiv.com/majority to receive an exclusive on-the-go bag, which features Proactiv's T-Zone Oil Absorber, Body Acne Wipes, and Green Tea Moisturizer. That's close to $100 value. And there's a 60-day money-back guarantee. And again, that's proactiv.com/majority, proactiv.com/majority, in order to get clean skin for the win. All right, folks. Of course, become a member of the Majority Report. That's how this ship sails. That's how we give you unbought, unbiased news. Do you see? On Tuesdays, TMBS last week, we had couple of great guests, as we always do. And tomorrow, joining us are John Iadarola and Artesia Balthrop. I will say some very big league upcoming guests. And the first one I will tell you about is the long-awaited return of Adolph Reed, which I'm incredibly excited about. Get your tickets to the TMB. And also, I'll say, because I've said this before, Abby Martin, very excited to have her on. Check out her Gaza Fights for Freedom documentary. Could not be more important. The humanity of Palestinian people subjugated in a pretty unparalleled way in the modern world. It's horrifying and necessary to understand that issue and center it. Patreon.com/TMBS. That's how you get the whole show. We have 83,000 subs on YouTube, and we want to get to 100,000 as quickly as possible. Helps us spread the word of what we're doing. So Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. We are well over halfway sold out with only – we're still over 4 weeks left to go before the Philly live show, so I'd snag your ticket. World Cafe, November 23rd, Artesia Balthrop, Crystal Ball, Emma Viglin. World Cafe, link in the show description. No age limits on this one, folks. So people who weren't 21 and wanted to come to the other shows, come along. Bring your folks with you. We'll see you. Jamie.
So this week on the Antifada, Andy and I discussed the extremely on-brand day that we had as goth socialists, in which we went to the Bernie rally, and then we saw the Misfits at night. It's pretty cool. We had on two guests this week. We had on our friend Sham Khanna, the editor of Commune magazine, to talk about what's in the new issue of Commune. And we had on Josh Strawn of the duo Azerswan to talk a little bit of spooky music and punk music and generally good music. Because, you know, October is a very important month for goth socialists. There's also a bit of a tie-in there.
Wait, what happened with... Oh, I'm sorry. Dumb question. Halloween.
There's right. Also...
I thought there was going to be like some hidden history that I was going to learn about. Okay.
Respect Halloween. My culture.
I was actually trying to really respect your culture. I thought I was going to learn something.
Oh, well, yeah. You will. If you listen to the episode, you'll learn about all kinds of spooky music of my people. But yes, there's also a tie-in because I am throwing a benefit show on Friday at Transpicos
this
in Brooklyn.
Friday.
Mm-hmm. This coming Friday, it's a resurrection of my Halloween party, Death Rites, that I didn't do last year, but I did it for like 7 years before that. And it's going to be raising money for El Comedor, which is a mutual aid kitchen in Tijuana that helps migrants stay alive while they're trying to get into the U.S. and going through all the horrible shit that they put people through when they're in that situation. Andy actually did some interviews with people there from the migrant caravan and people who were working to run it a while back that ran on my show. So ever since then, I've felt a connection with them and wanted to do something
awesome
for them. So I am. And it's going to be super fun and super freaky and super goth. And Azerswan is the headliner and their new album is very good. I've heard it. So if you want to come get freaky for good cause, come to Transpicos on Friday.
That's awesome. Of course, Matt Leck does a great podcast called Literary Hangover. Expand your horizons. Get literary. Check out Literary Hangover. Brendan is working on you called it the New York Jets meets a fish show.
Yeah,
podcast.
That's going to be definitely real and happen at some point in the future. Now, I got something cooking up. You guys might just hear about it.
I'm excited. Can you give me, is it writing or podcast? Can you give me a hint?
It would be a podcast, yeah.
Awesome.
Ooh.
I'm going to light a little fire under myself now. Matt took up a big swath of what I would consider doing a podcast in, but I'm not going to let that, that cornering stop me.
You got your own voice. You tell it.
Everybody's unique in a certain sense. We'll see you on the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer. You know what I'm saying?